The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a Monday morning, 9:14 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's the Roundtable panel, and a good panel today to begin our week. You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Brief, if you can. Paragraph, perhaps. No links, no attachments. Please proofread before you hit send. panel@wamc.org. Great panel today, and let's see if we've worked out our technical issues. Got an email a couple of minutes ago from UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, who said, my connection's not working. Is it working now, Jennifer Burns?
It is. I am here. Good morning.
Welcome back to the show. Immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here as well. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir. That's a very nice thing you just said to me.
What?
Good morning, sir.
Okay, well, good morning. It's a beautiful morning. Also with us today, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. And yeah. Libby, we heard Alex Dobkin coming in off the break here. And I know that you wanted to say a few words about Alex.
Yeah, Alex Dobkin, who is one of the founders and pioneers of the women's music movement, died last week. And she was, you know, for those of us who came out in the 80s and 90s, she was the woman who spoke and sang about our lives as lesbian feminists. And it's quite the loss for all of us. She was in the Mid-Hudson Valley, Ulster County, and I saw her a few years ago at Stuyvesant Books because she wrote a memoir, and it was lovely to see her. And she sang about our lives, and you know, in a way that nobody else really has in the women's music movement, as far as I was concerned. She was a staple at concerts here when we used to actually have concerts. I mean, this was way before the pandemic, and in all the women's music festivals. And you know, thank you for playing the woman in your life is you. And you know, it's a sad day, but it also shows that, you know, we're all getting a little bit older, and our mortality, we're facing our mortality. And she's one of the first to pass away, and she was really something. She was great, and somebody who many of us look to to reaffirm who we were at a time when it was really difficult.
Well,
that's the best way to put it.
That's well said, and we will be listening to the music of Alex Dobkin in and out of breaks here for the morning on the Roundtable, and it's the Roundtable panel. You mentioned the days when there used to be concerts. They may be coming again. But, you know, it seems like the entire pandemic has been one thing happens, and then there's something that counteracts that, and then it happens again. And no one seems to know exactly where to go, which is understandable. Everybody's sort of playing it by ear here, including the CDC. The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now defending the decision to ease mask-wearing guidance for fully vaccinated people, stressing that increasing political pressure had nothing to do with the abrupt shift in guidelines. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky told Fox News Sunday that she delivered the science as soon as it was available. To date, more than 156 Americans, more than 47% of the population, have received at least one dose of COVID-19 under the new guidelines released last week. Fully vaccinated people, those 2 weeks past their final dose of vaccine, can quit wearing masks outdoors in crowds and in most indoor settings and give up social distancing. Alan Chartok, you're a political guy. Was there some political pressure there after all?
Well, I'm sure there was. I mean, I think that what this shows is that President Biden is going to take a victory lap about all of this, and say, look, we did what we had to do. The other guy didn't. We did. And I think that's being proven right now. And, you know, it's a very tough time for Americans because a lot of us don't believe it. We believe Rochelle Walensky was saying just a little while ago that she was verklempt. She was really upset about, she didn't use that word, but really upset about where this all was. And now we have her leading the charge for reopening. So some of us say maybe a little early.
Well, we had six of New York's county executives, and Dave Gustino just reported that in the 906 News. They're calling on Governor Cuomo to update the state's COVID-19 protocols in accord with the new federal guidelines. Jennifer Burns, you know, you're on campus at SUNY Albany. Is this too early for your liking?
We at SUNY are in the midst of the graduation ceremonies, and the university's procedures were in place before this news came out, and it was that we would still wear masks. Most of the ceremonies are outdoors, but we would still wear masks the entire ceremony. So I think it's along the lines of putting it back on businesses and local institutions to decide what they're doing with this new information that has come out. I don't necessarily think that it was, or for me anyway, it wasn't welcome news so abruptly without other things put in place by the governor and knowing the response of many people that they don't want to wear masks. So Walensky's information that this was coming out right now and everybody should have it, but trusting that this will encourage people to go get, you know, the vaccine, when last week she was talking, or the week before she was talking about being fearful that we would not reach herd immunity, I think is quite problematic. But the University of Albany had their practices in place, and we are following them through for graduation, and I have not heard one complaint from anyone.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that people are ready to take their masks off, and I'll throw this to Sienna Freeman Tolbert. I saw an article over the weekend that said, you know, once we're allowed to take our masks off, there are going to be those who leave it on and leave it on forever. Agree or disagree, Sienna?
I certainly agree that there's going to be individuals that don't want to take their masks off. I for one, remember a discussion at my own office about how this has been the first year that no one has any codes, it seems like. It's not everyone, you know, there is a benefit to wearing a mask, right, outside of the COVID pandemic. However, on the other hand, I really believe that people, individuals, once we take this mask off, if there are other variants that occur or happen in the fall, it's going to be very hard to get people to put the mask back on. And that's my concern with the CDC's new policy, is that once we do this, it's going to be very hard to reverse it. And I think they're under the misconception that people will be willing to reverse it, and they will not. It's going to be very hard to get people to put their masks back on.
That's interesting. I mean, we've seen a lot of people die in this country, and I have a feeling that if things get bad again, people are going to slap those masks back on. But Libby Post, you're a political consultant, and you have sort of circulated through the halls of government. There is a certain skepticism, I think, that I see among a wide swath of people at all ends of the political spectrum. They're a little skeptical of everything that comes out nowadays, and everybody has a kind of a wait-and-see attitude. Agree?
Well, I think people who don't trust science and who don't want to involve themselves in any kind of critical analysis or critical thinking, and you know, will get in the Rand Paul camp of bashing Robert Fauci, are the ones that are Anthony Fauci, are the ones that are skeptics about wearing masks. I mean, you know, for those of us who understand that there's science is important, and that things are not always going to go as one had thought they were going to go, you know, science is fact-based, but things happen down the line. You know, when this whole thing started, you know, we were told one thing, and then as science progressed and we did more studies, we had more information. And so people just need to really understand that being a skeptic regarding public health is not healthy for anyone. And that we're not, you know, Anthony Fauci and public health officials and doctors and people who are concerning themselves with these issues and doing these studies and doing what's best for public health aren't doing this for their own amusement. They're doing it for our survival.
Correct.
And people need to get over the skepticism of science, which is one of the gifts that keeps on giving from Donald Trump. I mean, it started with George Bush with his concept of dumb science. But Trump really, you know, reinforced this notion that we don't have to trust science. And it's a deadly decision.
No, I think you inverted my point, but that's okay. I probably made it poorly. I mean, are people skeptical now of taking off the mask, not putting on the mask?
Ah.
Now we've heard so much all for a year, 14 months now, and people and science and politicians, everybody was, I believe, doing their best, but there have, you know, the stories and the trajectories have changed. Are people now, there are those who are like, no way, it's too early. Governor Cuomo's waiting a few days. Alan, is the science, is what Libby said, people trusting in science, is the governor not doing that now by not lifting that mandate right away?
Well, you know, science is a political choice. You may think it's not, that either it is or it isn't. It isn't. We know that. Scientists disagree all the time. I happen to think that the science is not here yet, and so I'm not taking off my mask, that's for sure.
Very interesting.
Well, what's so interesting about that?
Libby just said, you know, people got to believe the science, and this is a gift to us. You are still skeptical, and I think that was my point.
Yeah, well, it was a good point. Since it's also mine, and you know, I think that's right. Look, this is a very tough time for America. We saw ourselves walk into something which we didn't understand. We still don't fully understand it. We don't know how long the vaccine will last. We don't know if there'll be another outbreak, another surge. So it seems to me, and Libby's right about this, it's best to be cautionary about it. Now, if you're a politician and everybody's ticked off at you and they want their restaurants open and they don't want anybody telling them what to do, that's different because you're a politician. But if you're a sagacious, bright man like you are, Ray, then you would want to be cautious.
I don't own a restaurant. We do have an email here from Bob. And Bob writes, why would we think that in a country as large as this, there would be a single guideline for the entire country? Wouldn't it make sense to provide guidance based on local infection rates and vaccination status? Jennifer.
Well, I think that's, I mean, some of what the conversation right now is about is that the CDC puts this out and people take it almost as a global, you know, as global advice that in spaces, if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask. When I think many of us say, well, I trust science, but I don't trust people. And there's a lot of people who are faking vaccine cards. There's a lot of people who, you know, are lying about wearing or not wearing masks anyway, or, you know, if they've even seen a doctor about it or any of those things. So I don't trust the count on positivity cases everywhere. I don't trust that people are really following. You know, there's a lot of deniers that COVID is even real. And I know it's real. We all do. But there's still people out there saying it's not really that serious. And now CDC has said this, so it never was that serious. So I think it's hard to make something national, but yet when people hear what the CDC says, they do take it not just national, but globally as something they all can do now.
Interesting. This is the Roundtable panel, and we're joined today by Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Libby Post, and Alan Shartok. You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org is the email address. And Walter writes, can the people who wear masks while driving alone in their cars be explained? Well, we've all seen that, and I've had the same question. What do you think?
Well, you know, maybe they're smoking and they want to protect themselves. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's some people just sort of like it. They like it, and they keep it on. Maybe they're going in and out of their car a lot. You know, who knows?
Exactly.
I mean, it's personal. You know, we do still have a modicum of personal freedom in this country, and so people can make their own decisions whether or not to wear the mask when they're driving alone in their car.
Libby, do you wear a mask when you're driving alone in your car?
No.
What about you, Alan?
Yes.
I knew it. Oh, God. If there wasn't something, and that I'll was tell a definite, you why.
And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, when you get out of the car to go into the Big Y or wherever you're going, you always say, by the way, the before any
right.
institution in the Berkshires. You understand that?
Yes.
But if you're going into the Big Y and you're getting out of your car, it's, you know, you want to make sure that you remember to put your mask on. So if you never take it off, you don't ever forget it.
That's a good point. It's a good point.
Do you think so, Libby? Thank you. Ray did not think it was that good a point.
No, I think it's fine. Okay. You know what? I'm doing many things here, and I'm sure your point was excellent.
When somebody says, well, "I think it's fine,"
yeah, it looks good on you, though. Yeah.
That leaves a little something to be desired.
Tell you what, let's take a break. This is fun. Libby Post is here, political consultant and lobbyist, immigration attorney, and partner with Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Sienna Freeman Tolbert is here, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Jennifer Burns is with us, and WAMC's Alan Shartok is with us as well. We are just delving into the panel today. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. If you want to join the fun, panel. At WAMC.org is the email address, panel@WAMC.org, and we will get to more of the mailbag right after we break for news. This is the Roundtable on WAMC and a little British news, then we'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC, 9:34 on a Monday morning, and it's the Roundtable panel. Today, Libby Post, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Jennifer Burns, and Alan Shartok. You can join us by emailing panel@WAMC.org. And Paula writes, I don't care what the CDC says. I'm keeping my mask on in crowded places. I haven't caught a cold, nor have I had any allergy flare-up in the past year. Plus, who knows how the COVID variant will affect us. Until we know more, I'm keeping the mask on. And that is from Paula. This one says, this is from Dan. Science doesn't waffle. The CDC waffles. I don't trust waffles, but they are delicious. Mask up. And this one is from James in Saratoga. Just a reminder to the panel, some of us look better in a mask, and that's why we wear them. And that's from James in Saratoga. Well, Alan, now you have an excuse.
Exactly what I was going to say. I know you sent that to me, and I thought there was not such a hidden meaning that you thought that I was ugly and should wear a mask.
I didn't send that to you.
Oh, yeah, you did. It says, from Ray Graff to Alan Shartok. And,
what?
You know, yeah, I thought, well, I maybe...
Have you been hacked again? Well, we turn from that news to something that is... it's getting a little tense, to say the least. The Israeli military has unleashed a wave of heavy airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, saying it destroyed 15 kilometers of militant tunnels and the homes of 9 Hamas commanders. The strikes today came as international diplomats worked to end the week of fighting that has killed hundreds of people. The Israeli military said the latest attacks killed a local Gaza leader of the Islamic Jihad, a militant group. Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes across Gaza. Militants have launched more than 3,100 rockets into Israel since the fighting began. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken says has asked Israel for any evidence of Hamas operating in a Gaza building housing news bureaus that was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike over the weekend. Blinken says he has not seen any evidence yet justifying Israel's claim. He spoke today in Copenhagen, a day after the Associated Press's top editor called for an independent investigation into the Israeli airstrike. Alan, this is the most heavy fighting in probably 6 or 7 years over there.
Yeah, well, Ray, this is a very difficult one. You know, on the one hand, we see the Israelis confiscating buildings and land that belong to the to Arab people, to Palestinian people. There are many of us who don't think that that's right. On the other hand, Hamas does not have a sterling record either. They are anything but democratic in their orientation, and they are really putting an awful lot of hardware and rockets into Israel. This is not an easy one, particularly if you were raised adoring Israel, which I was, and you take a step backwards and say, you know, there are things I would be doing differently. And then you come to the whole issue of Netanyahu, a Trumper, if there ever was one, who clearly will benefit from all of this, because the reason he's been elected so many times is because there are there's a group of people in Israel, not a majority, because they have to, you know, they have to make coalition governments, a group of people who believe that he's the only answer to their safety. And so it goes. You have the same kind of split between Hamas and other rival, you know, Arab groups there. Their leadership, the leadership of Netanyahu, is clearly beneficial to keep this kind of thing going. It's an awful situation, awful.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday that Israel's attacks are continuing at full force and would take time. Israel wants to levy a heavy price on the Hamas militant group, he said. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, you've been watching this. This is a song that has been played over and over for decades. How do you make an end game here?
Oh, you're asking me the million-dollar question.
Yeah, well, go ahead. I'll go around the room.
Sure,
you can
is,
go
yeah.
first.
No, you had me going first.
Right now,
go ahead, Sienna.
What I was going to say is right now we all know the end game has to be a ceasefire. Right now, I mean, we can't look at the long term and to, you know, two-state. All of those questions are, you know, further down the line. We need a ceasefire right away, because right now the civilians are paying the price for what's going on between Hamas and Netanyahu. I mean, for us, it just seems like Netanyahu is just trying to distract from his corruption charges. This is a, you know, good distraction, and the civilians are paying the price. People are dying, and it is disgusting. And right now, the U.S. needs to use their leverage to facilitate a ceasefire immediately. That's my position. Because, you know, continuing to hear about all these children dying is very sad. And so that's what I think needs to happen immediately.
Libby Post, what do you think?
Ugh. This is so, as Alan said, this is just so difficult. I think, you know, I think what we need to look at here is the politics in Israel. So last week or the week before, the Israeli president called for a new coalition government because Netanyahu, while he won the election, couldn't put together a new coalition government. And now we see him escalating these attacks on Gaza, which, you know, the missiles were going the other way as well. I mean, it's not like anyone's blameless here. But from a political point of view, I can't help thinking that Netanyahu is using this opportunity to rebuild his political coalition so that when they do another vote in parliament, he can get his majority coalition and maintain his power. Yeah. You know, I think that this is political calculus on his part that's really pretty disgusting, but nonetheless, he's using it to his advantage. And this whole situation will never be resolved as long as not Netanyahu and his party and the right wing are in control of Israeli politics as they are now. And it puts the United States between a rock and a hard place. I believe in Israel's right to exist. I have always said that, and I will continue to say that. That doesn't mean I believe or agree with its policies and how it's dealing with Palestine and what's going on there and the way people are being treated. But I also think that there's this very, 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 very fine line between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, and only people who are enlightened and have done their reading and really understand these issues can make that fine distinction and then the rest of the world or the rest of the folks who have a knee-jerk reaction immediately say, these are the Jews that are being bad to people. And when that happens, it's the Jewish state. And when that happens, we then see this is a trigger for people's excuse to be anti-Semitic. And that's my fear in all of this. And we have seen this a surge in anti-Semitism in this country, regardless of what's going on in Israel, anyway, thanks to Donald Trump. But nonetheless, it all works together.
Alan, we have seen the Biden administration that has so far declined to publicly criticize Israel's part in the current fighting. We have seen parts of the Democratic Party leaning into the Biden administration fairly heavily here. This is a political tightrope for Biden as well, right?
It certainly is. Look, traditionally, the United States has stood behind Israel in at least one of the major wars. If the United States hadn't been there, you know, there might not be an Israel now. We know that Hamas is dedicated to driving Israel into the sea, and that has not changed. So this is a tough one for Biden. I think the politics are somewhat conventional, and yet you see some signals of his sympathy for the other side about saying that he and his wife both said everybody deserves to be safe. They are being very careful about this because there are an awful lot of Muslim Americans in terms of traditional politics. Forget about right or wrong. Traditional politics, you better watch out.
Jennifer Burns, a U.S. envoy, a diplomat, was meeting with the Palestinian Authority earlier today, and the U.N. is involved, but the U.S. always seems to take a major role in whatever ceasefires or peace process is going on. Is the U.S. being leaned upon too much in your view?
Big question. I don't think the U.S. is being leaned on too much, but I think, as Libby was pointing out, you know, I think the problem is domestic in the U.S. on how the response will be, because with the Republican Party in America shifting, and that evangelical base that is really supporting a lot of the Republican politics and tends to have a real xenophobic and anti-Semitic, not everywhere, but in many places, drive. I think that causes that tension in Congress that is puts Biden in the bind of really having to use that fancy word and strategy he's always trying with the bipartisan movements here, while, of course, some of the Democratic Party is splintering over this, calling out the U.S.'s racism involved in how they're going to treat Israel. So it's a big question, and I really don't know how to think about it.
Alan, we hear every time,
sir.
Two-state solution, yes or no, sir?
Oh, yeah. I think that's the way to go. The real question is who's interested in that? Now, one of the things I have against Netanyahu, it's quite clear he is not. He may make the point that, you know, at some point that, you know, maybe something like that. But basically, he has stood in the way, you know, of this. And then if it were, would that be enough? Would the Arab side, for example, say, okay, that's good for now. Now we have to, you know, continue to incite and do the rest. You really have to make it work. And that will have a lot of details.
Let's take a quick break here. It's the Roundtable Panel. You can join us by emailing. Send a brief one. Panel@WAMC.org is the email address. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post join us, and we have plenty to go. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 9:48 on a Monday morning. Beautiful one in progress. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Libby Post, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Jennifer Burns, and Alan Chartok join us on the panel today. You can as well by emailing panel@WAMC.org. This email from Karen. Karen says, how dare Libby talk about anti-Semitism when nearly 100 Palestinian children have been murdered? Zionism is the root cause of the issue. It's not Hamas and it's not Netanyahu. It's Zionism, which claims that Jews have inherent rights to the land and Palestinians don't. And in parentheses, Karen writes, Palestinians, the indigenous people, don't. Zionism is racism, and the world is finally beginning to realize that. That's from Karen. Libby, since you were called out, you may have the floor. Wow. Libby, are you there?
I don't know what to say about that. I've never considered myself a Zionist per se. I believe in Israel's right to exist. If that makes me a Zionist by someone else's definition, okay. But, you know, there are so many of us of my generation. Look, I'm a second generation Jew. I think, Alan, you're first, probably, that your parents came here off the boat, or maybe your grandparents did. I'm not sure.
One did, one didn't.
Okay. But it's I grew up with the Holocaust as a constant reminder in my house, and that 6 million Jews were killed, and that it's no excuse. I'm not saying that this is tit for tat, but it's hard for those of us who were raised, and my dad fought in the war, were raised with that constant reminder, to then turn around and say that the drive for a Jewish state is inherently racist. I'm sorry, I can't do it. And I also want to apologize for one other thing. And this is the vagaries, I'm sure, of social media and what we hear and what we don't hear and trying to track down the facts. Alex Dopkin did not die last week. And I am very, very sorry to her family. I tried to do what's right here because she is such an icon for the Lisbon community. She's home in hospice care, and lots of love and light is surrounding her. So
right.
I'm sorry for jumping the gun, but this is what I saw on social media all last week, was that she had passed away. And so I want to apologize to the family, but the tribute we're giving to her today is still well-deserved because she was such an icon for the lesbian community and for so long. And she was somebody that we all looked up to. And so I'm sorry. I really do apologize.
Well, it's good to play the music anyway.
Yes.
Your name?
I'm Ray.
Ray.
Yeah, temporarily.
No, you're Joe, actually.
Joe temporarily.
And by the way, Joe's not here because there is a family emergency, yeah. And he said I could say that. And
okay.
So
yeah, he should be back at some point this week, so maybe even tomorrow. So there you go.
So anyway, Rod writes us, the Israelis are illegally forcing Palestinians out of their homes. Alan, what would you do if a government forced you out of yours? Nothing sterling about what Israel is doing. Well, let me just say, Rod, whoever you are, that I have made that point again and again and again. So I don't know what you're shoving at me, because I do think the major Israeli mistake here is what they have done, forcing Arabs out of their homes and out of their area. So if you would just write your letter of apology now,
oh boy,
I'll accept it.
Okay. Or just think it very hard, and we'll pick it up here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. This email from Virginia. I visited Israel and the West Bank 2 years ago as part of a group fostering compassionate listening. We met with Israelis and Palestinians who are working for peace, and they are the most vilified people. Both sides consider these folks previous combatants, trauma therapists, past Hamas leaders, school founders, fostering peace, etc., as traitors. As long as this attitude continues, without the willingness to listen and work together, peace is a long way off. And that is from Virginia. Anybody?
I think, yes, we have to start listening to each other. And this is not an easy thing to do. And there has been times when progress has been made. But the last 4 years has not only polarized our country, but it's polarized the world and has made listening to one another more and more difficult.
Libby, do you think if the political leadership of Israel changes, if Netanyahu wasn't there, that there might be a tendency on the part of somebody new to try something a little different?
Yes, I do.
Me too. And I think that's the quandary of American Jews. A lot of us feel that way. So, many of us, as you have just stated, have a feeling that Israel should be there and continue to be there. But on the other hand, we don't like the internal politics of what's happening. And we have a lot of friends in Israel. And we talked to them all the time. We talked to somebody last night. They agree with that. There's a huge number of Israelis who think there's got to be a better way to do this. And that's why, Netanyahu can't put a government together.
Right.
Anybody else want to comment before we go to the next one? This one's from Janice. Why is no one addressing the egregious imbalance of military power? Most Hamas rockets are shot down by immense Israeli firepower. Israeli forces are bombing civilian apartment buildings. Palestinian casualties outnumber Israelis tenfold. Palestinian goods and services have been blockaded by Israelis for 14 years. This is apartheid, plain and simple. Jennifer Burns.
Well, this is why I now wish I had gotten further on my reading list and read Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle book, because I think that's what, within the Democratic Party in America, you have people like Cori Bush and Alessandra Ocasio-Cortez, who are bringing to the forefront this global movement against systemic racism and the militarizing of governments against people. So without having more research done on my part and more reading done, I still don't know what to say or where to go with it. I need to learn more.
Sienna Freeman Tolbert.
Listen, I will say, and I think I tried to bring it up earlier, is that, the civilians are paying the price, and that, the attitude that because Hamas tends to be in buildings with civilians, that makes it right to bomb the whole building, it's just hard for me to digest, right? There has to be a better way. There has to be a better way to defend, for Israel to defend themselves than, attacking places where there's civilians, where there's women, where there's children. It's hard for me to really accept the justification for that. I think there's just has to be a better way than that, especially since they have superior technology. So I just couldn't imagine I would ever accept America doing anything like that. And in the same way, I don't accept it in this case. I understand the need to defend. However, there has to be a better way than bombing places where there are civilians. I mean, it's just unacceptable to me.
Let's take a quick break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, if you would like to share your thoughts on what we're talking about today. It's the Roundtable Panel. And we have Libby Post with us, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Jennifer Burns, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. We'll take a quick break for news, and then we'll come back, and we will have much more to come. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a Monday morning, 10:05. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Libby Post is with us. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Jennifer Burns, and Alan Shartok. And the email is really coming in here on this topic. This one's from Diane. Diane writes, I agree with Alan. A two-state solution is the best solution, but it's so complicated. Israeli settlements on Arab land, nationhood of Israel and its sovereignty, reduction of U.S. military support of Israel, plus long before 9/11 and even more since then, most Americans have been anti-Arab, anti-Islam. Lots of Arabic nations deserve our disapproval, but not all. I hope and pray for a two-state solution, but what can we do to help it along? And that email is from Diane. And since we've been hearing a lot from Alan and Libby so far today, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, what are your comments on that one?
on the two-state solution. I mean, listen, I don't presume to. I took a course in undergrad about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't presume to understand everything about the dynamics in that area. However, you know, I think a peaceful solution is what I'm for right now. And so right now, my main concern is, you know, protecting vulnerable populations. And right now, the vulnerable population are the amount of kids being killed in Gaza. I know there has also been people lost on the Israeli side as well, and we need to protect those people. So that's where I stand. I stand in protecting the vulnerable population as soon as possible.
Jennifer Burns.
I guess my question is, what would that look like when it comes to, because I agree with Sienna, I think we often lose sight of all the people who are dying who are not, you know, involved in the shooting off of rockets and that sort of thing. But I guess my question is, what would a two-state, how would this work, the relationship between the two? Because part of the kind of manipulation or the warring that is going on is cutting off, you know, power and fuel and the border to allow things in and out. And that's part of how this is unfolding to further traumatize people who are living there, those who are not in fear or are dying because of the missile strikes. So how would that work? I mean, how would these leaders and global powers or allies put in any kind of policies to help rebuild or help business dealings be somewhat safe, equitable, and not manipulated?
You know, I think everybody has to realize that part of this is how to get it done. You know, I announced before, and I've been for it for years, a decent two-state solution. But when you have a premier of Israel and the leader of Hamas opposed, really opposed to this because it would take their power away, it's very difficult to do. So you not only have to look at the general idea, who's for a two-state solution? Hold up your hands. Good. That's a lot of people. Now, then you have to take a look at who stays in power because this stuff is going on. And we know that that's true on both sides.
This email from Bob, and this gets to the point we've been discussing. Bob writes, Libby's position that the Holocaust entitled the Jewish survivors to a land of their own begs the question of where and at what cost to others. The world has plenty of relatively empty spaces. Example, Greenland. Their choice of Palestine, regardless of its already being occupied, was driven by a belief that a historical presence trumps current human rights. That has resulted in an ongoing crime against humanity. And that is from Bob.
Let's not forget that in 1948, there was a two-state solution proposed with an economic union between the two states. And the Arab world said no, and the Arab world turned its back on the Palestinian people. So, you know, when you talk about this, let's just look at the history that went on at that time when they were trying to figure out what to do. Let's also not forget that boatloads of Jews were turned away from this country, right? When they were trying to find a place to go, they've left Germany, they're on a ship, they try to come here, they're turned away in country after country. Some of these people ended up back in Germany and dying in the camps. So let's not forget the history that happened before Israel was established and the history that was tried to be established in terms of a two-state solution in 1948.
Anybody else?
I'm done with my diatribe now.
No, that's okay. Alan, you want to comment before we move on?
No, thank you.
It's the Roundtable Panel. The email address is panel@wamc.org. It's about 10:10 on a Monday morning. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney is criticizing GOP colleagues for downplaying the January 6th riot and condoning former President Trump's lies that the 2020 election was stolen in several TV interviews on Sunday. Cheney cautioned that there is no question an attack like January 6th could happen again. The Wyoming Republican has been ousted from GOP leadership in the House for challenging Trump, basically. But she says she'll continue to speak up on the dangers of undermining democracy. Alan, you guys have been talking about this on this program for quite a while now, but this story does not go away.
No, and nor is it going to, nor should it. The fact of the matter is that Liz Cheney, whatever her conservative views in the past about birtherism and everything else may have been, she is right on this one. Look, if Trump had had his way, we would not have a democracy or anything approaching it in the United States. He is a would-be dictator. He shows all the same signs that Hitler and Mussolini and all the other guys did in the beginning. He wanted to take away an election. And he is still disgustingly and outrageously undermining the American people's belief in a fair transference of power via election. And that is really awful. It is, as far as I'm concerned, a major criminal act. So Liz Cheney, for whatever the issues were in the past, she is saying the right thing about preserving the American democracy. And I have great admiration for her at this time for doing it.
You know, I don't think I was around when Malcolm Nance was on last time. But I know you guys were talking about this. Does he feel that the January 6th uprising, or whatever you want to call it, riot, could happen again? And is he concerned about that?
Well, I think he's writing a book about it now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I do think he has that. I do think, Ray, he has that concern. I met him on the street in Hudson this weekend, and we had quite a little conversation, but not about politics. You know, I truly believe that he's a man of such sensitivity and such understanding that he knows what's going on in this country.
Interesting that, you know, Donald Trump, he's not the president anymore, and yet we have Stefanik on the news this weekend saying he's the leader of the Republican Party. Voters determine the leader of the Republican Party, and they continue to look to President Trump for his vision. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, is that a winning strategy?
Oh, no, not at all. But what I think is, you know, what this told me by them ousting Liz Cheney is that, you know, if I ever had any, like, I thought for a moment that the Republican Party would move back, you know, to their old leadership and they would go back to their ways. Now we know for sure that they solidified their support behind Donald Trump. If anyone ever had any doubt before, it's there. And I don't think it's a winning strategy, because I really and truly believe that they are alienating the independents, they are alienating the moderates, and they are galvanizing the progressives and the Democratic Party to fight against this Trump party. That's what happened at the last election. It's going to happen at the next election. He's very polarizing, and people want to go to the polls to vote against Trump and anyone that supports him. And so I think it does not work in the long term.
Libby
well,
Post.
In the short, oh, but go the ahead, question Alan. Then, I'm sorry. The question then is the short term. The short term, these guys, these feckless, problematic Republicans who know better, they know better. Don't tell me they don't know it. Are basically doing whatever they can to preserve their own individual offices. And the last thing they want to do is to take Trump on. We all know that. So yes, they are doing what they need to do in order to preserve their positions, but they are also risking everything. Because the more, as you say, the more the middle in this country sees what's going on, sees that the guy's trying to rob the American government, sees that he did, in fact, send those people down to the Capitol to do their damage. As far as I can see, this is really where it's at right now. And the Republicans, in the long run, you're quite right, will lose. But in the short run, they keep their stinking offices.
Libby Post, you're a political consultant, and so I asked you this, and this is not my idea, this has been out there, but is the ousting of Liz Cheney from her leadership position in the House, is that a blow for the Republican Party's future in that there could well be a split at some point?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, everyone's talking oh, we can't do a third party and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Trump talked about forming a third party when he was thrown out of office because they wouldn't overturn the election results. So this is fealty to that insanity, right? And some of these people are actually saying yes. Although Lee Zeldin, who's running for governor on the Republican line in New York, has said no, that the election was real. But be that as it may, I do think that we're going to see a third party come to fore because there are fiscally conservative, maybe even socially conservative folks who are disgusted by what is going on in the Republican Party. I have cousins. I mean, I hate to say this, but I have cousins who left the Republican Party when Trump got elected. They're conservative academics and, you know, are now writing for the Bulwark and all that sort of stuff. But they are disgusted, and I can see a third party coming to fruition, one that will come out of the Lincoln Project so that there's money there. There's media savvy there, people like Steve Schmidt, people who still uphold classic conservative principles, but not the Trumpian principles. I mean, Trump is played into the hands of the radical Christian right, and the whole Israel thing comes into that as well. But that's another story for another day. But you know, I do see a third party coming, and one that could eventually eclipse the Republicans if the Republicans stay on this trajectory of only talking to 30% of the country.
Alan.
I don't agree with you. You know,
okay.
Surprise.
I don't agree with you. No, on the contrary, I'm a great believer in Libby and the things that she says. However, on this, I think that the polls are pretty clear. That by and large, you know, 80%, 90%, depending on what poll you're looking at, think that of the Republicans think that Trump is a good guy and has done a good job. They are not deserting him. And it comes down to American racism. It really does. That's what it is all about.
You're absolutely right, Alan. It's the remaining Republicans. The fact of the matter
well, that's
is
right.
an exodus.
Well, no.
There has been an exodus from the Republican Party.
And yet the polls are all pretty clear that unifiedly they're there. They're not throwing Trump out or his ideas out. And that's because they always had power in this country. And now they don't. And now they have to give that power up. And so they're not with them. They are with the Trump and not with the potential Democrats. And this is going to be a major test of whether our democracy holds together, because a majority are clearly not with them, as you have suggested. And therefore, what do you do now? You know, you go into a general election, you're going to lose, as you have said. That's what it's about.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. Taking a pause here before, at the end of each statement, because I really can't see anybody, and if they want to jump in, I kind of have to wait a second or two. But I take it, Jennifer or Sienna, you don't want to jump in there.
Well, I see this a little bit differently. I mean, I agree with what everybody's saying, but I see this as the silent majority no longer being silent. And so Liz Cheney is somebody who's really in the minority, because even
in her party,
she's a
minority in her party, but not among the American
party.
People. Yeah,
you know. And so I think what's happening is, for me anyway, the way I see it, is that people like Liz Cheney, no longer have the party the way they used to operate it or the way they'd like to see it operate. And so now she and whoever else will join her probably don't have enough to form a third party that will be successful. They're going to have to look to vote Democrat to regain the Republican Party that they used to have, which was of that silent majority tactic. Otherwise, they are siding with outspoken racists and white supremacists, and that's just what it is. And Cheney has called out this violence is going to happen again. It is.
Alan,
it's been happening a very long time. It's going to happen again.
Alan, you know, we talk, we have been talking about the potential for a split in the Republican Party. Is there a chance for a similar schism in the Democratic Party? We have a certain faction that is far left of where President Biden is, and they are applying a fair amount of pressure in various areas to him politically, including on Israel and in many other ways. Could that at some point reach critical mass, and could there be a split in that party as well?
Well, there's always a possibility of a split, but let's look at the logic of the thing as just articulated so beautifully. The Republicans are for Trump. They're for the Trump ideals. The mass of Democrats are not. So what you have now is a group of very determined, very specific people who are on the left. But they're not running that party the way that the right-wingers are running the Trump party. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Anybody?
I agree.
I agree.
Wow.
Wow, that's great.
I ought to do that more.
The email address here is panel at WAMC.org if you agree with Alan. Panel at WAMC.org. This email from Bridget, it's not about Trump. It's about those 64 million voters. Alan.
Huh? I don't get it. In other words, the argument here is it's not about Trump. The allegiance isn't to Trump. Oh, really? Because if you take a look at the Bushes and what they're thinking about now, and the Cheneys, the former vice president, and the daughter of the vice president. No, I think that's a new, that I think there is a widespread adherence on the basis of that. We don't want to lose our power in this country, and we're all for it. And these socialistic, I'm using that, that's sarcastic.
Okay.
These socialistic, you know, people are coming along and trying to take our money and our taxes, and we don't like it. And yes, please.
It all comes down to maintaining political power. That's what this is all about.
Sure,
and Republicans have see Trump as their way of doing that. And it's in these swing, in these districts. It's not like it's nationally, you know, it's in these various districts where if there's a Republican primary, whoever Trump backs will win. And so it's these Congress people who have no backbone except for wanting to maintain their position because they make a lot of money being a congressman, you know, who are saying yes to Trump, yes to Trump, yes to Trump, and playing into then and supporting the white supremacist trope. And if we don't think that this isn't part of all of this, you know, the racism and the white supremacy is part of who now the Republican Party is, period, end of story. And I do think that there are Republicans out there who are disgusted by it. I don't think every Republican, you know, I think every Republican probably, as everyone does, has their own racist tendencies. We're white and we raised in a racist country, but I don't think they all are saying, let's don the KKK hoods and go back to where things were. And some of these people, that's what they're saying. Get rid of the blacks, get rid of anybody of color, get rid of the Jews. This is a white Christian country. And that's how they want this country to be defined.
Well, and I think the key for people to understand is, go ahead, Sienna.
No, you go ahead, Jennifer, sorry.
Okay. I think the key is that for Republicans who are disgusted, they also have to remember that by supporting, you can be disgusted with, say, Kevin McCarthy's flip-flopping and this revisionist talk that's going on, you know, with that whole ridiculousness that January 6th was like a normal tourist visit, you know, I mean, all this craziness. But that's a strategy of white supremacy, because it's built on domestic violence, right? That's what it is towards other people. So you rewrite the story. Yes, and you rewrite the story, even though there's footage of you terrified in the corner, right? Like, you'll still rewrite the story to benefit yourself. And I think what many Republicans who are teetering the line, saying, well, we don't really like this stuff, what they have to remember is, if you will vote for this person in your local district, then you yourself are making racist decisions. You are supporting politicians who are going to systemically continue to put in place things that perpetuate and nurture racism. So if you want truth out there, if you still want, say, some advantages and tax breaks and all those things, then you need to move away from people like Stefanik and McCarthy and this group that has gotten control of the Democratic Party and is cultish towards Trump, because what they're doing is actually reinforcing racism through policies, even in your local area. That's what they are going to do. So this is the difference between being not racist, right, if you're a Republican, and being anti-racist. If you are not racist, you say, I'm not racist, and I am, I don't treat people in a racist way personally and things like that. But if you are supporting these elected officials and their talk and their decisions, then you are implementing racist acts through the government, through those laws. So to be anti-racist would mean to vote for others, even in your local area, that are going to look to eliminate systemic injustice. Because eventually, this systemic injustice that Trump is talking and these others are putting up there, it's going to come back at you. That's what you're feeling now, right? This call that everybody white is a racist in the Republican Party. This is how systemic racism and white supremacy work. They turn on their own people. Sorry, I'm done.
It was good. Leaving a pause for anybody else. We only have about a minute here before the break.
How do you want to fill it?
Oh, no. I thought somebody else wanted to talk, but that's okay. This email from Kathy, who says, I almost never agree with Libby, but I think she's right that the third party will come from the left of the Republican Party, which will then become the Trump Party, because such a party will attract many independents and conservative Democrats. And that's an interesting concept, Libby.
Well, that's how the South got lost. That's how the South got lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson stood up and said, we shall overcome, turned around to somebody and said, I just lost the South. And he was right.
Wow. You didn't sound like Libby. Libby.
Well, I'm so
sorry. Not only that, but you know, Nixon's Southern strategy was the beginning of all of this.
Sure.
In terms of modern day politics, not the beginning of
the Civil War was.
All right, we got to take a quick break here. It is the roundtable panel. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Jennifer Burns join us, and there's more to come on this program. You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Try to keep your message brief, and we will try to get to them after the break. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable on WAMC. It is 10:34 almost. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. The Roundtable panel is in session. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Libby Post, Jennifer Burns, and Alan Chartok. The email address is panel@wamc.org. And Rose Marie writes, Alan, I agree with you quite often. There's nothing more satisfying than when someone agrees with my point of view. This reminds me of how the Republicans and Democrats cannot agree. It is not easy to be objective and to look at the other point of view, especially when there are heightened feelings and anger at past wrongs. We all know that it is important to keep an open mind to other ways of regarding issues and to try to understand each other so we can continue learning, even if it means we do not agree.
Do you think that's the Liz Cheney comment? I really didn't understand where she did or didn't disagree with me.
It really doesn't say. It just, the subject heading is agreeing with Alan, and so I thought that would be good enough for you.
Well, there is one person who is convinced that the way to get your letters read on WAMC is to always caption them, I agree with Alan.
Yeah.
But you have to read the rest of the letter.
Okay. Well, I think that was a nice piece of thinking that can be applied across many parts of the world. This one is from Paul, and Paul writes, Liz Cheney has on more than one occasion suggested that Congress subpoena Kevin McCarthy, the minority whip. What does she know? that he should reveal about Trump's duplicity?
Well, or about himself?
He already said it.
Said what?
I mean, it's out there. What that? He said that day, he called the president, or he called Trump, I hate to call him the president, to say you need to send in the troops, the National Guard, you need to do something about this, and that Trump just sort of shrugged. And the idea that that Trump didn't know what was going on, there's footage of him and his family watching everything from a tent. So we all know that he knew what was going on.
Alan.
I don't have to say anything after that. Libby's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the whole thing, we keep talking about the big lie, but the whole thing is the big lie.
Right.
And so, you know, it's so easy to dismiss it as the big lie, other than to say the guy, which I have been saying since the very beginning and got a certain amount of criticism for, is a lying liar. But he does that. And that's how you lose a democracy. Somebody shoves their fist in your face and says, eat it. That's what they do.
Anybody else on the panel?
I was just going to say that I think what she's saying, you know, I think it's directed at the Department of Justice. And I think what needs to happen is to stop the big lie from perpetuating. You know, everyone needs to be held accountable. And yes, you need to subpoena them and have them swear under penalty of perjury that this is exactly what happened. And so you can keep someone to their story. I think it's important. And so I think that's something that the Department of Justice needs to look into. And they do need to subpoena him and get him on the record so there's no more flip-flopping.
Remember that when he was sworn in, he put his hand on a Bible and basically said he was going to tell the truth. And, you know, Congress people lie all the time. So if you start with, you know, I'm all for it. Don't get me wrong. And he is a liar. But if you start with that, you're going to have nonstop, especially when the other guys get in or get control of the Congress.
Well, Kevin McCarthy,
you know,
really.
I was thinking more so. Okay.
Go ahead, Sienna.
I was going to say briefly, I was thinking more so in terms of all these prosecutions going on with what happened with the rioters on January 6th. So, you know, and I know that they're looking at bigger fish. And so I was thinking more so of that prosecution than just in general bringing a congressman in to swear. I was thinking in terms of trying to get a subpoena him so they can do indictments.
Makes sense. And when you say a bigger fish, or a big fish, very big fish. Jonah met him.
Yes, we want a big fish.
By the way, Rosemarie checked in and said, my comment about agreeing with Alan and being objective is intended to be a reply to hearing Alan's surprise at nobody disagreeing with him before the break, and to reply to Alan saying people should agree with him more often. So there you go, Alan. People are agreeing with you more often.
I love it.
All right, this one's from Norm. Norm writes, the polls presented in the media are sculpted to a desired result. Those people polled who identified as being Republican does not provide scope, numbers interviewed, or geographic location. The media seems to want the Trump drama to drive angst and ratings, fueling the social division. And that is from Norm. Does anybody want to comment on that?
Well, anything is possible. You know, I tend to be much more attentive. I knew somebody who married a guy once, and none of us liked him. And I said, why did you marry him? She said he was attentive. So I think, look, we have to understand that I tend to be attentive to the polls. I think that, you know, they make a percentage point wrong here. They get an election wrong there, but not by much. And I think when they poll the Republicans in this country and they say we're standing by him and he's our guy, they know it and the people in the Congress know it and they're all scared to death of him.
This is written by Denise. Denise says, I've heard Alan say over and over how Republican senators and representatives are taking appalling positions because they're cowards who are terrified of losing their positions and income. While he may well be correct, I'm wondering if he can point to several or any recent Democratic congresspersons who have shown greater courage. And that is from Denise.
Well, as the guy said in the paper chase, I'm not prepared, Professor. Mm. No, I'm. Look, there are many, many people on both sides who can take positions that are dictated by their party, and I know that. I know that when I say something on the air, that is less than some of the people on the far left want. They're going to criticize me and criticize me heavily. I try not to let that change my mind, but who knows?
Anybody else? Boy, I can't wait until we are back in the same studio. It's much easier to signal everybody.
Yeah.
This is from Chris.
Time to talk.
Exactly. Chris, his subject heading is Classic Conservatism Has No Constituency. Chris writes, it's been conventional wisdom for a long time that a majority of Republicans believe strongly in conservative values. But if people like Cheney and the Lincoln Project can't get broad support for conservatism, shorn of sexism, racism, and reactionary politics, the Civil War is over before it starts. Outside of the GOP, do any ordinary people really care enough about classic conservative values to join and vote for a third party?
No, third parties don't do well in this country. We saw it. We've seen it before. We've had presidential candidates. Whatever the way it all came down, George Washington warned against faction, and that's what we got. We've got faction, and we have these two major parties that compete for power in this country. And I suspect we'll continue.
By the way, did anybody see 60 Minutes last night?
I did.
I didn't. I didn't because
no?
I was sleeping.
Well, you know, it's stunning to me as somebody who's followed this stuff for 40 plus years. But they did a UFO thing last night, and we only have a few minutes left, so I thought I would bring this up. UFOs are very real. 60 Minutes reports they're still unidentified. They're not American, and they had some military folks on, and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, and they really don't know what's going on. And I think that when this, there's going to be a Pentagon report that in the later days of the Trump administration, it got through. And I think the due date is sometime in June. When this thing comes out, I think it's going to be huge news. Did anybody see that segment last night and want to comment on it?
No, but I'll tell you something right now. You can go into the BerkshireEdge.com and look up my column from last week on UFOs.
Really?
Before 60 Minutes, by the way.
Of course.
I always think they're listening to me and grabbing my stuff.
I'm sure.
I'm sure. but the fact is, they've got to be. Look at all, stand outside at night and look at all those stars. And that's just one universe, one constellation. Think about all. Are we so arrogant that we think we're the only ones? It's crazy.
Well, you make a classic logical leap that UFOs necessarily have to be from outside of this planet. And I don't think they said that yesterday. Libby, you said you watched this, right?
No, I did not watch it last night.
Oh, Jennifer, did you say that you had watched this?
I did watch it.
What's your take on it here in a minute or so?
Well, they did suggest that it could be aircraft that's not being claimed by other nations.
Right.
And it's highly sophisticated and kept secret so that we don't in America know what it is. But, you know, part of me as I was watching the story was thinking about all of our exploration to Mars. And 60 Minutes had a special, I think it was maybe not this past weekend, the weekend before that, about what people are trying to, the scientists are trying to gather and collect from Mars and look for former life form. And between the two stories, it made me think, you know, where else have we not been or discovered where there is some kind of life form that is far more sophisticated than us visiting us?
I mean, to be clear, I am not saying I disagree with Alan's jumping to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, because some of these things, as reported by the Navy pilots and other military people, clearly defied physics as we know it. I mean, imagine going 40,000 miles an hour in a drop of a hat and then going straight into the water and going just as fast. These are things that hopefully will be explained or at least examined in this Pentagon report, which is coming out sometime in the middle of June. Sienna, did you say you watched that as well?
No, I did want to take a moment to look at the footage because I enjoy Star Trek and Star Wars, and so it's not very far-fetched to me. And I must say, it was very convinced. The footage, I was convinced it was a UFO. I understand that it may have been some unclaimed country's aircraft, but I don't believe it. I think it is. I think there are other things out there, and I think that's what it was. It looked. Gosh, it was amazing.
Yeah, isn't
it
though?
To me, at least.
It is amazing. And a lot of these stories get pushed off to the side or, you know, for decades, it's the lunatic fringe and, oh, it's the silly season in the summer and you see it in the news. But I think things are turning as far as people taking it seriously. Chris Mellon, who is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, said, hey, these are not a secret U.S. government technology, and I can say it with a fairly high degree of confidence. We will pick this one up, and now that I've started this topic, Joe Donahue can bring it up, and I'm sure he'll have a lot of fun with that. Hey, we're out of time here on the panel. Sienna, thanks for being with us today. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
Jennifer, thank you for being here, and we will we'll see you next. I guess you'll be on next week, right?
I'm not sure, but I'll check my calendar.
All right, we'll talk to your agent. Libby Post, thanks a lot. Alan, I know we'll see you both of you soon. Thanks.
Like it or not.
Thanks to
all.
Yeah,
and I'm just glad I'm not the only Star Wars fan. So.
All right, we'll pick this topic up in the future when this Pentagon report comes out. Thanks for listening. More Roundtable ahead.